official K-1 podcast, K-1 Battlecast. You'll get news, fight reviews, and fighter interviews. And now, your hosts, Michael Shaverov and Jonathan Scheer.
It's good night, Iran!
Hello, everybody. I'm the voice, Michael Shaverov. Great to be with you again on another episode of the official podcast of K1. It's K1 Battlecast. I'm joined, as always, by my verbal sparring partner in Tokyo, Japan, Jonathan Scheer. G'day to you, Jonathan.
Well, g'day, Michael. It's a pleasure, as always.
Mate, before we get underway, I've got to say a big happy birthday to you. How are the birthday celebrations going?
Ah, how kind of you to remember. No, they went great.
What do Japanese traditionally do on their birthday? I mean, we've spoken before about the eating, you know, the soba noodles around Christmas or New Year. How do the Japanese celebrate a birthday?
They work, Michael. They work.
Well, mate, I hope that you have a really good one with your family today and your friends. I know your best friend is me, and I'm down here in Melbourne. But when I come to Japan next, we will celebrate both of our birthdays. We are both April born. And here's a fun factor about April born people, in that I'm April 10, and surrounding my birth date, there are quite a lot of K1 fighters who also have their birthdays around the same day. Now, if I remember correctly, Ronnie Sefo, the younger brother of Ray Sefo, is April 9. I think Glaube Feitosa is April 12, and I believe Jan the Giant Nortier is April 11. I'm in between them on April 10, and I also share April 10 with Steven Seagal. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but hey, it exists. And April 7 belongs to another great martial artist in Jackie Chan. So April is quite the celebrated month for K1 fighters and for martial artists.
Well, I did not know that, and it feels like I'm in really good company. That's good to know. Thank you, Michael.
Well, Jonathan, another big episode today as we continue to look at the participants in the K1 Max Final 8 to be held at Yoyogi Arena on July 7 in Tokyo. And today it's all going to be about Romano Backboard, the Dutch Surinamese fighter. So let's get stuck into it and talk a bit about Romano Backboard. Let's deep dive into how Romano qualified for the Final 8, and he did so by defeating the Thai Tenenchai. The first thing to note here is that the odds were stacked against Romano Backboard from the get-go to win this fight. First of all, he gets the call up to fight Tenenchai with only 2 weeks' notice. That in itself is monumental. You're not only getting a late call up, but you're going to fight the guy who's being touted as the new Buakaw. You're going to fight the guy people are already saying could become the new K1 Max champion. And you're giving away experience, you're giving away height. And then to add pressure even more to Romano, he weighs in 900 grams over, so he's punished. He has a point deducted before the fight even begins. 20% of his purse is gone. And the fight is in 10-ounce gloves for Buckboard, not in 8-ounce gloves. So there's a lot of pressure. The odds are really stacked against Romano from the opening bell. Still, Romano has this real chill attitude about him. Nothing seems to faze this young man. From the moment I met him, Jonathan, at the photo shoot 2 days before the fight, he had this confidence about him. And I spoke last week about a similar zen-like confidence to Daryl Verdonk. Buckboard also had a very quiet confidence, if not maybe a little more brash than Daryl Verdonk. But I saw Romano as a fighter who understands how good he is and had the intention to go out there and show the world that he was ready to seize this opportunity given to him on only 2 weeks' notice. And completely and utterly unfazed that, again, he was fighting a guy in Tenenchai from Sitsom Pinong Gym, a fantastic gym in Thailand, who many people were already predicting to be the new K1 Max champion. It just didn't faze Romano. The photos, the interviews, the constant media pressure, the questions, the cameras in his face, the microphones in his face, it didn't faze him whatsoever. He took it all in his stride. He handled it well. He had this tremendous story prepared. And I give him credit because whenever I'm talking to fighters, whenever I'm talking to athletes in any sport I commentate or, you know, I do voice training, presentation training, commentary training, I'm always telling athletes and former athletes, and you've got to have a story. You've got to have something the media can embrace, a point of difference that sells you to the world. Now, Romano Buckboard has this amazing story. He comes out to the ring in a monkey mask, and he's known as the crazy monkey or the bad monkey or the dangerous monkey. The reason being is that when he was young, kids would pick on him at school, calling him a monkey because they believe he looked like a monkey when he was young. So in the playground, they'd do the ooh, 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 ah, 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 bang their chests and, you know, hold up bananas to him and pick on him and call him a monkey. Now, you know, I've got two young sons, and if one of them got called a monkey like that and got jeered and hissed at and picked on by someone at school, I'd be really upset. And I know it would emotionally and mentally affect my children. It did affect Romano Buckboard, but he spun it into a positive, because when he started martial arts as a means to, you know, transcend that realm of getting bullied and a way to develop self-confidence, and when he started later fighting, he took the ring name The Monkey because of it was the name they used to pick on him with at school. And he thought to himself, I'm now going to use it to empower me. I'm going to show those bullies who called me the monkey to tease me that now I'm the monkey who can conquer the sporting world. It's a wonderful story. It really is. And I mentioned it extensively on the commentary on the night, and I think it was wonderful that he had this you know, story prepared, and all the media really did embrace it and got into it. So I really do appreciate the monkey moniker of Romano and the story behind it. So the fight starts, and you've got a chess game of two styles. Tananchai staying on the outside, using his reach to keep Romano on the peripheral, and Romano looking to get on the inside. And I like the aggression in Romano Buckboard. He pursues Tananchai around the ring. He shows off his handiwork early. He's got a good jab, but the main weapon of Romano Buckboard seems to be the lead hook. It's not the tightest hook. It's long. It has quite the trajectory, but it works for Romano. Another positive sign Buckboard shows us early is his double forearm guard. He protects himself from Tananchai's knees, which is very hard to do because Tananchai, you know, high-level Muay Thai champion, tall. He's the type of fighter, physique-wise, who is made for the clinch and knee game. And this double forearm guard works a treat for Buckboard. And it also defends against Tananchai's jabs. It's a really tight guard that Romano is quick to establish. Some fighters pull up the double forearms guard slow, but Romano pulls it up really quick. I mean, he pulls the trigger on that thing and it springs to life like triggering a mouse trap. It's quick and it's tight. It's, you know, I used to say a virgin's defense, nothing penetrating. And Tananchai had real problems getting inside this double forearm guard. I love this guard from Romano Buckboard. It also protected him a lot from the uppercuts. And we all knew that one of Tananchai's specialties was the uppercuts, which is rare for a Muay Thai fighter, but it works for Tananchai. And Tananchai did throw the uppercuts against Romano. You see them throughout the fight, particularly early on. They look good, but they hit Buckboard on his arms on those double forearms guard. It doesn't score under K1 rules for Tananchai. So study that closely when you go back and watch this fight. Now, I've also got to say, Jonathan, when I was calling this fight live alongside Stuart Fulton on the global feed on Triller, I was thinking that Tananchai won the rounds. But the more I watch this fight, the more I realize how much more accurate Romano Buckboard was, and how so much of what Tananchai threw just didn't land on the target. In the second round, again, we see that Tananchai has the volume. He's throwing more. It looks good. But if you study it closely, it's not landing to target. It's mostly hitting Buckboard's guard. And when Romano lands, he's landing a lot cleaner, even though the volume is significantly less. And Romano doesn't relent. He keeps coming on. He keeps pressing forward and forcing Tanenjai to fight on the back foot, which is very hard to do, particularly for a Thai. There is a period with about 90 seconds left in the second round that Romano seems to stop, and that's concerning for me. Tanenjai gets in two or three clean uppercuts, and Romano's corner, Michael in his corner, is barking at Romano to pick up the pace. You can clearly hear this on the broadcast. It concerns me that Romano just switches off for like 30 seconds. I don't know what happened. Did he feel confident enough to take a breather? Did he feel like he was leading the fight? Did he need to regain himself and get sort of a second wind? He didn't look gassed to me, but he sort of just switched off, which is concerning. Buckboard gives a dogged third round, lands some big punches, and the fight goes into an extension round. Now, I've got to say, I was surprised on the night that Tanenjai didn't take the decision. But the more I watch this fight, the more I see the goodness of Romano Buckboard. It deserved an extra round. Jonathan, what do you think? Do you agree? Because I believe we discussed this on the night, and I think we were both in the same boat that we thought Tanenjai had won it after three rounds.
Now, please don't get me wrong, because I think he's a fantastic fighter, but I wasn't quite convinced that Tanenjai did win it. I felt that he was a little bit awkward with the K-1 rule set, and that transitioning from Muay Thai, though he's extremely strong and capable, Buckboard, as you said, was so good at defending, there was a certain awkwardness, or even as we got later in the fight, a certain desperation in Tanenjai's approach. I thought Buckboard took it.
You know, again, watch it closely, folks, on Triller. Grab the pay-per-view, have a look, put it in slow motion, rewind it, score it at home, and you'll see that Romano Buckboard does a lot better than we initially thought on the night. It goes the extra round, and as the extension gets underway, Romano is straight in Tanenjai's face. I love this. I really do. He comes out like a house on fire. Romano's chin is tucked. The guard is up watertight. He's throwing hooks. He's throwing calf kicks. It's a great battle. And Romano shows tremendous heart and spirit and gets the win and books his ticket to July. Jonathan, this was massive for Romano Buckboard, who was an unknown before this night. I'd never heard Romano Buckboard. He may have been known in parts of the Netherlands, in parts of Europe, certainly wasn't known worldwide, wasn't known around Asia, made a name for himself. Not only through this great fighting style that was very entertaining to watch, but he beat a pre-tournament favorite, and he did it in grueling fashion. It was a big shock.
I totally agree, and he did so with very little damage.
And just a comment here on Tanenjai, I was thoroughly impressed by Tanenjai's adaptation to the K-1 rules, which is very difficult. It's a hard transition to go from full Muay Thai rules where elbows are allowed, the clinch is allowed, you know, two-handed or single-handed clinch, all the knees you want. You've also got 5 3-minute rounds as opposed to 3 threes in K-1. It's a totally different fight set and a totally different style when you're doing Muay Thai to K-1, and Tanenjai adapted really well. It was only when he started to tire in the extension round and late in the third round that he got a couple of warnings, a couple of cautions from the referee for the clinching. But other than that, I'd like to see Tanenjai get another roll of the dice in K-1 Max somewhere down the line. Wrapping this one up on Romano, I like Romano Buckboard. I like the story. I love the monkey mask. I like the Rocky Balboa style of fight. Chin tucked, comes in, looping punches, nothing to lose, prepared to go out on his shield. He is the Rocky Balboa of K1 Max in 2024. I'm a fan of Romano Buckboard. Jonathan, I know you're a fan of Romano Buckboard, and I think this bloke is a real chance to take the tournament on July 7th. Maybe to get to the final at least, but perhaps to steal the show and upset more pre-tournament favorites.
You know, I really agree with you, Michael. And the fact that he escaped relatively damage-free from a high-level fight speaks volumes about his talent. So he's going to go far, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, that's us talking about Romano Buckboard, but it's time to speak to the man himself. We go all the way to the Netherlands. Romano, Thanks so much for joining me on K1 Battlecast. Romano, let me start by asking, you came into the K1 Max Final 16 on short notice. How long before the fight did you actually find out you were fighting?
Michael Polano, my trainer, told me 10 days before the fight.
What was your reaction when you found out you were invited to the K1 Max Final 16?
I felt happy and see it as a dream come true. I work for it since I was 5 years old, so I was very excited, very happy.
Were you a K1 fan growing up? Tell me about watching K1 as a kid.
Yes, for sure. I was a big fan. Everyone should be a fan of the K1, especially back in the day. If they don't, then I think they must have been living under a rock or something. But no, I was always watching the K1. What I can remember, I was watching it on the videotapes. And after the videotapes, my brother and I pretended that we were also going to fight, and the K1 in our room, that was crazy, crazy times.
I've got to know, who was your favorite K1 fighter growing up?
I have not really especially one favorite, because there were so many good fighters at that time. I can't choose one, but for sure, in my favorite list, Remy Bojanski, Andy Sauer, Buakaw, Basato, Badahari, of course, and as the host.
My favorite K1 fight of all time, I mean, there's a few, but I've got to put Mike Zambides versus Chahid right up there. How about you? What was your favorite K1 fight of all time?
That is very easy. That is 1,000% for me. Mike Zambides versus Chahid Ulid El Haji. That fight was crazy. 4 rounds of full action.
Crazy, right? And I was there that night. Now, you fought Tennant Chai in the final 16. Some people believe that Tennant Chai won the fight after 3 rounds. What are your thoughts on the scorecard after 3 rounds?
I don't agree. A lot of what he did was on my cover and besides, and he was just walking backwards the whole time and holds me a lot. And the K1 criteria is about the fighter who makes the fight come to fight and is more offensive. And make the better clean shots. And that is what I did. And that was enough.
You increased the pressure in the extension round. Tell me about your strategy in that 3-minute extension.
Well, it's not very special strategy. The only thing that I know on that moment is that I have to give everything and work even harder to convince the jury and win the fight.
Romano, it's always a cauldron that you jump into when you're fighting in Japan, particularly in Tokyo, for the first time. What was that experience like for you?
It was very, very wonderful experience that I want to experience much more. It was going quick. I can't wait to be there again and enjoy more and more and more.
Moving forward to July 7, you'll be facing the man with the spinning back fist from hell, Viktor Akimov. Tell me about your thoughts on Viktor's fight against Rei Nakajima.
Rei make it easy for him because he was walking, moving on him to him with his hands low. But Akimov punished him well, so that is what he's doing is great.
Do you believe you come into the fight against Akimov as the favorite or the underdog?
Really, I honestly don't care about that, and I'm not focused for now on that. But I'm sure I will be the favorite fighter after the fight.
Okay, so also on your side of the draw, Romano, is Zora Okopian and Kasper Majinski. Who do you believe advances to the semifinals out of those two, and why?
Oh, honestly, no idea. I think they will be very evenly matched, and I think that will be a technical, beautiful game, but I hope for the winner that he comes with not too much damage, because I'm waiting for him in the semi-final.
Besides yourself, big question here, who do you consider the favorite to win the K1 Max?
Everyone can be the favorite. That's not the problem for me. But my job is to make sure the whole world knows who the man is with the monkey mask. And after that day, July 7th, I will be the favorite.
Now, Romano, the wild card may be the great Buakaw. If it is Buakaw, what are your thoughts on him coming back to the K1 Max?
I hope he is there and that I mean meet him in the final. That will be the icing on the cake. If he is not there, I want to face him after this tournament. Tenjai was seen as the next Buakaw, and I defeat him. So now it's time for the real Buakaw.
July 7 on paper feels a long way away, but really it isn't. Have you begun your camp yet for the K1 Max final?
Yes, of course. I rest my body for 1 week after March 20, and then I start again with my training camp, and I feel my super fit and even more focused. So I'm full in my training camp.
What does a day of training look like for you?
So I train 9 times a week, 3 days at the week, 2 times a day, and 3 days once, and 1 day rest. In between, I often visit the physiotherapist, the masseur, for a massage, and I visit the sauna, and I'm very busy with my D8. And of course, after all my trainings and everything that I have to do for July 7, I cannot to forget that I'm making time for my son. That's my biggest motivation in my life.
Romano, it's been so wonderful talking to you, brother. Can you give a final message for your fans, both in Japan and around the world?
People, the monkey is coming. Be ready. July 7, I will leave my soul in the ring. See you there.
There he is, Romano Buckboard, joining us on K1 Battlecast. All right, we delve into the mailbag. And Jonathan, I believe we've got a very interesting question all the way from Croatia today.
That's right, Michael. We have a question from Vlad from Croatia, who asks, was Giorgio Petrosian the best K1 champion of all time? What do you think?
Vlad, that is a great question and a really hard one to answer. For me, it's actually harder to answer than who was the greatest K1 heavyweight champion of all time. Specifically, though, your question asks about Giorgio, so let's break that down. Giorgio Petrosian fought about 8 times in K1 Max. He also fought in K1 Fighting Network shows and other K1 shows in Europe, but in true K1 Max, he fought 8 times. It's not a lot, especially when you consider that 6 of those 8 were in the K1 Max final tournament, both of which he won. So, out of all the K1 Max champions, being Kraus, Buakaw, Masato, and Sauber, Petrosian actually fought the least amount of times in K1 Max. That said, he crammed those 8 fights into 2 years. And those 2 years were 2 wonderful years. 2 years when we saw a fighter truly at the top of his game. For those 2 years, Vlad, watching Petrosian was like watching Jordan at his peak, or Lionel Messi, or Wayne Gretzky, or Hakuho. He was a world above the rest. Petrosian was an artist. He was untouchable. I mean that. He was untouchable. In those 8 fights, he won 2 by knockout and the rest by decision. Petrosian wasn't a barn-burning knockout artist like Buakaw at his peak. He wasn't a fighter who took one to give one back like Kraus or Masato. He never, ever, ever seemed in trouble. This was the magical, riveting, perplexing, intriguing thing about watching Petrosian. He was never fazed. I don't think he was ever knocked down. I don't think he ever got bled. I don't think he ever got a scratch, a cut, or a bruise. The only thing Giorgio ever hurt were his hands. That was it. I mean, I've never seen that ever before with any other K1 fighter. For those 2 years, Petrosian was as close as you could get to the perfect fighter. Everything was perfection. It was flawless. Was he the best K1 Max champion ever? Well, the big flag for me here is the fact that he never fought Masator. He never rematched Buakaw, who he drew with controversially, mind you, when he was younger. So that's two of the four other K1 Max champions that he never fought in this period. As for Sauer and Kraus, he never had problems with them. He beat Kraus twice in the quarterfinals. He beat Sauer in the 2009 final. And let me tell you, that win over Sauer in the 2009 Max final was utter brilliance. Giorgio made it look like a Sunday morning sparring session. It was art, sheer art, a performance you could hang in the Louvre. That was the second time he beat Andy Sauer that year, the other being in Milan in March of 2009 at a non-K1 event. Man, I remember commentating with Mike Kogan and sitting there ringside at the Buakaw, mouth agape, struggling to commentate because I was just locked on the beautiful experience unfolding before my eyes. Never had I seen a fighter of this caliber string together such exquisite combinations, land everything, and I love you, Andy Sauer, and Andy knows this, but Giorgio absolutely tooled Andy Sauer that day. Now, the other fighters that Giorgio beat in this impeccable two-year run were Jabir Askarov, Yuya Yamamoto, Vitaly Gurkov, Iron Mike Zambides, and Yoshihiro Sato again. No Kishenko, no Gago Drago, no Masato, no Buakaw, of course, no Koiru Maki. So there's a lot of questions there. Now here's the million-dollar question. Would Petrosian, version 2009, beat Sauer 2007, Buakaw 2005, or Masato 2008? We will never know. Deep down though, in my gut, I think Petrosian would have figured them all out. And I think he would have beaten each one of them. He was that damned good. Vlad, wonderful question, my friend. Hope all is well in Split, Croatia. Make sure you venture to Sarajevo in June for the K1 World Grand Prix. Hope to see you there, mate. But a fabulous question. And keep them coming, folks, in the listener mailbag. Some juicy news coming out of Sarajevo in Bosnia, where they have announced the eight combatants who will compete in the K1 World Grand Prix that takes place on June 29, the K1 World Grand Prix Sarajevo. Here are the participants. One of these men will qualify for the K1 World Grand Prix final to be held December 14 in Tokyo, Japan. Now, Jonathan, this is a very good lineup. Let me tell you about it. Here we go. Ivan Bartek of Slovakia, Adnan Redzevic of Bosnia and Herzegovina, Igor Mihailovic of Croatia, and then a name familiar to all of us, he may come in as the pre-tournament favourite, Claudio Estrate, and those cannonballs, the Italian. Nidal Bciri of Morocco, always love to see the Moroccans. Last time we saw a Moroccan tear up K1, of course, was the great Barahari. Could we get another Moroccan star in Nidal Bciri? Then Danilo Tosic of Bosnia and Herzegovina, Alin Nicita of Romania, and rounding out the eight is Kadir Yildirim of Turkey. Good lineup. Solid lineup. Great to see Estrate in there. Also, I've heard great things about Ivan Bartek of Slovakia. I've heard great things about the Moroccan as well, Nidal Bciri. Danilo Tosic is going to be no pushover. And don't forget, you've got Tosic and Redzevic fighting in front of their home audience in Bosnia and Herzegovina. It is going to be a wonderful Grand Prix, and it will be the first qualifying World Grand Prix event in, wow, what will it be, Jonathan? About 14 years, right?
My goodness, has it been 14 years? It was 2010, I think.
Looking forward to it either way. That will be on June 29 in Sarajevo. And also there is more news coming out of Galați, Romania, where on June 13, the K1 Fighting Network returns with a massive show in Galați, Romania. In fact, Jonathan, it's going to be so big, they are holding the K1 Fighting Network Romania show inside a football stadium. We believe a number of guests are going to be there ringside, including Remy Bendjaski, Alexei Ignashov, maybe Ernesto Hust, and a whole lot more. But that will take place on June 13 in Galați, Romania, and it will be inside an outdoor soccer stadium. That's crazy.
Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, remember, K1 used to be filling up the Tokyo Dome, Saitama Super Arena, these really big venues. So that's great.
Exciting times ahead. And folks, we hope you enjoyed our deep dive into Romano Buckboard, a participant in the final eight of the K1 Max on July 7 in Tokyo, Japan. But before we get there, don't forget, we do have K1 Sarajevo on June 29. That's a K1 World Grand Prix qualifying tournament. Before that, June 13, K1 Fighting Network returns in Romania. That's going to be crazy. And then July 7, Tokyo, Japan, the final of the K1 Max. Jonathan, that's a wrap for this week. Next week, we'll be talking to another K1 Max fighter. We may try and get the big fella himself, Dengue Silva, the big crazy mosquito from Brazil, to chat to us next week, or maybe even a man who is experiencing a brand new level of superstardom in his home country of Poland, Kasper Mierzynski. Either way, we'll have another K1 star for you next week. Folks, I'm Michael Schiavello.
And I'm Jonathan Scheer.
Thanks for joining us, as always, on K1 Battlecast.
Join us back again next Friday. We upload each and every week. We have our socials, Facebook, we have Twitter, Instagram. And if the mood strikes you, you can send us an email with your burning questions about what happened behind the scenes here at K1. We hope to hear from you soon. Until next time, have a great week.